From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the October 2022 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Shark Attack. In February 1942, the worst fears of the teams working on Naval Enigma were realised. The German Navy introduced a new, more complex Enigma machine for use by its U-boats in the Atlantic. At a stroke, Bletchley Park was no longer able to read messages sent by the German submarines, which were hunting the vital Atlantic convoys. By the end of the year, however, this new code had been broken, and Bletchley Park was once again able to divine the secrets of the Atlantic U-boats. But just what was Shark, and how was it broken by the team at Bletchley Park? In this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to find the answers. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
In this episode, we'll be talking about Naval Enigma, but before we start, I want to get right back to the basics and ask about what makes Naval Enigma different. Is it just the system as used by the Navy, or were there different types of Enigma machines?
Well, this is a mistake that a lot of people make when people talk about the Enigma machine. Actually, there's a family of about 20 different machines in the whole evolution of the device, and you don't need to worry about most of them. When people talk about Enigma, they mostly talk about the I machine, which is the Army and Air Force machine that was used by the German military during World War II, with three rotors and a plug board. And that's what we normally refer to when we talk about Enigma. And for the first couple of years of the war, the German Navy Enigma, although it has a different name, sort of categorization, is basically the same. You have the I for the Army and the Air Force, and you have the M1 for the Navy, mm-hmm. And then that becomes the M2 and it becomes the M3. But the changes between the different models don't affect the functionality. The functionality is identical to the Army Air Force machine. You have a plug board, you have three rotors, and that's the Enigma we all know and love. Mm-hmm. What's different for the Navy, and the reason we have Hut 8 doing Naval Enigma breaking and Hut 6 doing Army and Air Force Enigma breaking, is that the different armed forces have very different procedures for how they use the machine, how they set up the machine, how they set the keys, the daily keys, and all that kind of thing. And even with the M1, 2, and 3 machines, when the naval machine is still identical to the Army and Air Force machine, it's already much more difficult to break because the Navy have operating procedures that make their system more secure than the way the Army and the Air Force use the machine. One example of that is people who are regular listeners to us will know that one of the ways you can break Enigma is because the operator has to choose the rotor setting at the start of each message, and humans aren't very good at being random, and so operators would often use predictable settings. In the Navy, they're given a book of settings which have been generated in advance, so the operator doesn't get a choice about which setting he uses. He takes one from a book, so it's already more secure. And in addition, the way that setting is communicated to the recipient of the message, in Army and Air Force messages, it's often encrypted, but it's encrypted in quite a basic way in the preamble of the message. The Navy use a thing called a bigram substitution table, where they jumble up those letters in a much more complicated way. So from the outset, Navy Enigma is more difficult than Army and Air Force Enigma. Mm-hmm. The other thing that makes Naval Enigma more complicated, even from before the war, is that the German Navy have more rotors to choose from to put in the machine than the Army and the Air Force. There's three slots in the machine, and the Army and the Air Force have five rotors, which means that you can have 60 combinations, 5 × 4 × 3. So there are 60 variations of rotor choice. The Navy have three rotors, numbers 6, 7, and 8, which are exclusive to the Navy, and they have the same 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 that the Army and the Air Force have. So you now have 8 × 7 × 6 possibilities, which is 336 choices instead of 60 choices. So it's vastly more difficult. Actually, they don't use all 336 because one of the rules that the Navy has is that you must always use one of the three naval rotors, 6, 7, or 8. You can't just use 1, 2, and 3 because the idea is that there's always one rotor in there that the Army and the Air Force don't have in the combination. So there's actually 276 combinations which are available to the Navy, but it's still way more.
Still distinctly more complicated.
So, yeah. Although the machine is superficially identical, it's already more complicated. The main way you can tell them apart, if you see one in an exhibition, is that the rotors on the Army and Air Force machines have the digits 1 to 26 mm-hmm. round the rotor.
Yes.
Which I've never quite understood why they do that, because it represents A to Z.
The letters, yeah.
The Navy rotors have the letters A to Z round them.
Right.
So one way to tell a naval machine is that they have letters rather than numbers on the rotors.
I'll be using that in future as I see an Enigma machine. Did you know, by the way?
You can be caught out because the naval rotors do fit into the Army machines. And right. We, for a while on site here, had an Army machine that at some point in its history had had Navy rotors put in it.
Aha.
So that's not necessarily diagnostic.
Okay.
However, if you look in the top right-hand corner of the Navy machines, next to the battery compartment, they have a plug socket because it was quite common on a ship, because the ship has an electricity supply, you could plug a electric feed directly into the Enigma machine. The Army and the Air Force machines have two little screw terminals that you can screw an external battery to, but they don't have a plug socket. So the quick way to tell an M machine from an I machine is to see, has it got a plug socket and has it got letters on its rotors? But apart from that, it functions the same.
We've been getting a lot of letters from listeners who advise cooking with steamers and two-tiered saucepans, if you have one. This is, of course, an excellent plan and saves a lot of fuel. A listener from Belvedere, Kent, used an old saucepan lid. Well, they usually last longer than saucepans, so you'll probably have one or two to spare. Turned it upside down and knocked some holes in that from the inside. It balances marvelously on top of another saucepan, and you can put in your vegetables and cover it with the lid belonging to the saucepan underneath.
The Germans introduced a whole new system of their naval Enigma. Can you tell us a bit more about what that change was? How did it differ from the naval Enigma machine that you've just explained to us?
Yes, this is what happens in 1941, although it's actually introduced to traffic in the spring of 1942. They come along with what's called the M4, and people confuse this because the M4 machine has four rotors instead of three. Some people think that's why it's called M4. Mm-hmm. It's not. There's actually been an M1, an M2, and an M3.
Yeah, the M1 doesn't have one rotor.
No. So it's the next in the sequence, but it has four rotors. And I pause slightly before I say four rotors because the fourth rotor isn't a real rotor in a way. To go back to an ordinary Enigma machine, an Army machine or an M3 naval machine, the current that passes from the key you press to the light that comes on goes into the three rotors from the right-hand side. It goes through each of the three rotors into a thing called an Umkehrwalzer, or a reflector, and it's turned around in there, and then it goes back through the three rotors and then goes to the light bulb. But what the fourth rotor in the naval machine does is it replaces that reflector. So instead of having a normal reflector, which is a kind of cylindrical lump about 5 centimeters thick, they've taken that out and they've created a reflector which is only about 2 centimeters thick, and next to it is a skinny rotor, and that rotor can be moved to different positions around the reflector. So you've got 26 options of reflector mm-hmm. instead of one.
Right.
Later in the war, the Army and the Air Force introduce a pluggable reflector, which is a way of varying the reflector. But this is the first time any kind of variable reflector is introduced. What this means is that what is called the fourth rotor isn't the same as the other eight. It's not interchangeable with them. You couldn't get this fourth rotor and put it in one of the other slots because it's the wrong size and shape. But what it does is it gives you 26 more options for setting up the key. And in fact, gradually, the German Navy introduce more than one reflector and rotor set. So the first one introduced, they have a thin reflector B mm-hmm. and a thin rotor beta, which is Greek for B. Mm-hmm. And then later on, they introduce a thin reflector C and a thin rotor gamma, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's the third letter of the Greek alphabet. There's been a lot of speculation about, is there not a thin reflector A? But there doesn't appear to be. But I think what it is because the Army and the Air Force machines have two reflectors, B and C. There was once an A reflector, but by the time you get to the war, it's not used anymore. So they produce a B and beta for the Navy, which is equivalent basically to the B rotor in the normal machine. And one of the crucial aspects of this is when they get the new machine, if you go into a U-boat, in the signals office, there's a compartment in the desk which you can slot the Enigma machine into. So the new machine has to be the same size externally as the old machine because it won't fit in the slot in the desk otherwise. So the new rotor and the new reflector are designed so that the case of the machine is the same size.
Mm, right.
The second and more important thing is both the B reflector and the C reflector with its partner rotor has a position you can set it to, normally A, where it works identically to the old reflector in the three rotor machine. And what that means is if you're on a U-boat that's been given a new four rotor machine, you can set your machine to a certain position. If you set that fourth rotor to A, your machine will function exactly like the old three rotor one. So if there's somebody on another ship that's only got a three rotor machine, you can talk back and forth to them.
So they can
pretending to be a three rotor machine.
Yeah.
But then if you want to talk to somebody who's got a four rotor machine, you can move that rotor away from A and you get the benefit of the extra encryption. The final thing that makes the fourth rotor not a rotor, if you like, is that in a normal Enigma machine, the three rotors are all pushed round one position. Well, first one goes around 26 times, the second one goes around 26 times, and so on. The fourth rotor in an M4 machine never moves. There's no lever to push it round. And so once you set it in a particular position, it will stay in that position forever. This isn't actually a problem, because if you think about it, the right-hand rotor's got to go around 26 times before the middle rotor goes one position. And then that's got to go around 26 times for the last.
It would never move, would it?
It would basically never move.
Right.
So you'd have to write a very, very long message for it to move.
Which they didn't with Enigma messages.
Do. Whether it moves or not doesn't really matter. And because it's thinner, it would have been very difficult to make it move. And interestingly, on a Typex machine, the British cipher machine, some of the rotors on there don't move because they appreciate the same thing, that actually you'd have to write such a long message for it to make any difference, that just the ability to set them is enough. So you have a machine where the box is the same size, but it has this layer of extra 26 times more complexity embedded at the one end. And it's even more than that because you can have thin reflector B and thin rotor gamma, or you can have thin reflector B and thin rotor beta. You can swap all the pairs around and you get many, many more key possibilities. So that 103,000 million, million, million number that we talk about the key for normal Enigma, I haven't done the maths, but the naval Enigma number is even more vast.
You mentioned that you could set it so that if you were speaking to a ship that hadn't had this upgrade, I suppose, that that was possible. Was that the case at the beginning? This was required that you'd only have to set it to a particular setting so that the rest of the Navy could be communicated with? Or was this rolled out across the whole Navy?
Yes, that is part of the plan. It's a bit difficult to identify when M4 was first conceived of, but it's fairly clear that they were aware that they would have to roll it out alongside the existing system. So it has this sort of retro setting that you can position it to work like the old machine. But one of the things that Admiral Dönitz, who is in charge of the U-boats, keeps coming back to in terms of cipher security is the more people that use a particular system, the more vulnerable it is. And the reason they get eight rotors earlier on is because the Navy want to partition their traffic off from the Army and the Air Force, because it reduces the risk of compromise. You know, if somebody's doing something dodgy in the Air Force, the Navy don't want that to affect them. And further, the first thing he does to further secure his U-boat traffic is he says, right, at the beginning of the war, the U-boats used the same key settings as the whole of the rest of the Navy. He says, no, that's not secure enough. We need a separate bunch of keys just for U-boats in the Atlantic. There's a previous network, which the British refer to as Dolphin or Heimisch, which is the home waters network, which at the beginning of the war, all the German Navy used Heimisch, basically. They have a second key for ships that are on the other side of the world. And already, Dönitz has been able to separate Heimisch from the Army and the Air Force by all these pre-war changes. He then says, right, within that, we need more than one key. We need a separate key for U-boats.
And just to quickly ask, when you say key, that's a sort of set of settings?
It's a set of settings, yes. This is something a lot of people don't realise. On any one day, all of the Enigma machines in use by the Germans aren't all using the same setting. Each of the different groups of units, the SS have a key, you know, different bits of the Luftwaffe have different keys. So there might be a dozen or more different keys in operation on any one day. And obviously, if you break one of those keys, you've only broken one. You haven't got access to all of the others. So if you're concerned about your Enigma security, one of the ways to make it more secure is to break it down into little chunks and give each chunk a separate key. Mm-hmm. It's more complicated because you still have to generate that key and you have to issue the relevant paperwork, the sheets with the keys on them every month. You have to give them to the relevant people. And it's kind of diminishing returns. If you have too many keys, A, it's very administratively very difficult. And secondly, the person on that key might want to talk to the person on that key. So there's a happy medium.
Right.
But he thinks if he can have a separate key for his Atlantic U-boats, it will increase the security of their traffic because it's separated off from the rest of the Navy. So when Shark, as it's known at Bletchley Park, what the Germans call Triton, this network that we're going to be talking about, when that's first created, it uses the same three-rotor machine as the rest of the Navy. It just uses different settings. So it starts out just as a different key. But later on, once they've rolled out enough of the M4 Enigma machines to the U-boats, they can then go from not only having their own key, but having a four-letter key instead of a three-letter key, which of course gives them a vast amount of added security. And that's basically what they do on the 2nd of February 1942. They've rolled out enough machines across the fleet that all of their U-boats in the Atlantic now have one and they can start using it. And on the 2nd of February, all those Atlantic U-boats start using four-rotor keys, using the full potential of the M4.
Vom Einsatz unserer Unterseeboote im Karibischen Meer. So ging es wochenlang durch die schweren Winterstürme kreuz und quer durch den Atlantik. Erst mitten auf See erhielt das Boot seinen Einsatzbefehl. Beobachtung und Störung des Schiffsverkehrs in der Karibischen See. Es geht wieder in die offene See hinaus. Der Funker am Horchgerät stellt Schraubengeräusche fest.
Auf Gewehrstationen!
Mündungsklappen auf! Sind auf! Der Kommandant sieht sich den Fall nochmal an. Ein Dampfer schwankt im Fadenkreuz, ein fetter Bissen. Rohr 1, Rohr 2, los! Ein Torpedo hat gesessen. Der Kommandant lässt auftauchen. Ein schneller Rundblick. Wieder hat der Feind ein paar tausend Tonnen kostbaren Schiffsraums verloren. Die feindlichen Transporter sind vor den Torpedos unserer U-Boote nirgends mehr sicher.
This change of system came in on the 2nd of February 1942, but how long had this been in the works and why did they think it was important to make these changes?
In order to manufacture enough machines and figure all this stuff out, it's been quite a long time coming. And one of the reasons that you notice that is when Bletchley Park was looking at the key settings procedure for the old three-rotor machines, it's a bit weird that the way you encipher the message setting, the rotor settings, uses a four-letter system. Basically, they would take the three letters they'd chosen for their setting and they would add a dummy letter, and then they would do this process of substitution with a table. But you go, why are they using a dummy letter? Why do they need that? And actually, it's because they already know that they're going to use a four-rotor machine later on. So they've already built into the mechanism space to accommodate that fourth rotor when it happens. And so clearly, they've been planning this for a while. The other question is really, why in January 1942, you know, why is this chosen to be the moment? There are various incidents which suggest that Dönitz, as commander of U-boats, was getting more and more worried about U-boat security. I don't think you could argue that it's an overnight decision, because obviously the logistics of getting all the machines made and getting all the keys written and everything else, it must have been something that was in the works for a long time. But there are a couple of incidents which were quite possibly catalysts for it, where he goes, yeah, we really need to get on with this and get it done as soon as we can, because there's a possibility that our messages are being read. The first of those is in September 1941, when two U-boats are scheduled to meet near the Cape Verde Islands in the Atlantic, which is the middle of nowhere. They're scheduled to meet up so they can transfer stores between them and things. And they turn up at their rendezvous, and there's a British submarine there, which rather unsuccessfully doesn't manage to sink either of the U-boats. But it certainly raises eyebrows, because the Germans are going, well, surely that's not a coincidence.
In the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere, you know, how would that happen? The chances of that happening by fluke are really, really low. And in fact, HMS Clyde, the submarine, was there because an Enigma message had been read.
Right.
The Germans get suspicious, but this is something we've addressed before. There is this problem that when the Germans get suspicious, they always, or in all cases, they find something else to blame, because they trust the technology of Enigma, but they have a big fear of human compromise, the idea that there's a traitor somewhere in the system that's sharing the secret.
So there's this unshakable belief in the unbreakability of Enigma, but even if they start to suspect it is breakable, it's easier to find a softer target, I suppose.
Yeah, and one of the explanations they give is it's quite plausible that a traitor within their ranks has given the British a monthly key sheet, for example, or that the British have captured a monthly key sheet off a ship, which in fact they did several times.
Yeah.
But the Germans reassure themselves and go, well, that means they can read Enigma for a month. But as soon as that sheet expires, everything's secret again, we're all right. What they don't appreciate is that during 1941, Bletchley Park manages to pinch enough key sheets that Alan Turing and the rest of his team are able to reconstruct what's called the bigram tables, which produce the encryption of the message settings. And so he doesn't need to capture sheets anymore because he's kind of figured out the underlying system, if you like. And that level of vulnerability they never identify. But there are a couple of places in the German records where it's clear that they are worried about a compromise of their system. And after the Cape Verde incident, the U-boat command war diary records exactly this. And it says, either our ciphers have been compromised or it's a case of leakage. A British submarine does not appear by chance in such a remote part of the ocean. The naval staff is requested to take the necessary measures to safeguard the cipher system. So they sent somebody off to look into the problem and figure out what was going on. A chap called Rear Admiral Martins, who was the investigator, if you like, came back. And unfortunately for the Germans, he decided that there wasn't a problem, basically. What he said was, in the last few weeks, there has been no evidence of leakage either through cipher material, which we have previously lost, or through espionage. Those are the only two options they're really considering. But for operational security, it seems important to make every effort to restrict the circle of personnel having access to secret material and thereby reduce the chances of betrayal. The more important ciphers do not seem to have been compromised despite their heavy use and occasional loss. So what he's saying there basically is what I've just described, saying it's possible that a key sheet's been stolen or whatever, but the basic concept is solid. And he makes the point about reducing the chances of betrayal. And this is the idea of reducing the number of people who have access to each key and have access to each version of the system, which is what this operation is all about.
You mentioned this dummy letter to create a four-letter encryption of the settings, as it were. Is that something that Bletchley Park was picking up on? Were they able to deduce that there was something to do with maybe four rotors coming into this system? Did they have any advance warning of this change?
Yes. I mean, well, there's two questions there, because what you have to realise is we're talking about a change that happens in February 1942. Bletchley Park has only been reading three-rotor naval Enigma since the summer of 1941. So they've only been actually in naval Enigma at all for about 6 months. So they're still quite new to the whole thing. And the way they get into naval Enigma in late 1940 and into 1941 is by a series of pinches of key sheets and settings books and other paperwork and procedural materials surrounding the machine. And basically what they do is they create the message setting of three letters, and then they add a dummy letter, and then underneath it they put another block of four letters, and then they take each vertical pair and look it up in a book, and that book gives them a different pair of letters, which they then use. It's what's called a bigram substitution, and then that pair of letters is sent to the guy at the other end, and he reverses the process. And the break into three-rotor Enigma has happened because Bletchley Park have been able to unpick all of that system by capturing the relevant documents.
Right.
So they've already spotted the fact that there's a four-letter system being used to encrypt the message preamble, the message setting. The significance of the fact that it's four, not three letters, hasn't necessarily sunk in at that point. But there'll probably be people looking at this going, why are they putting a dummy letter in it? Why not just use three letters?
Yeah.
There's something afoot here, you know, so they've got a bit of a clue. And in terms of your second question, how much wider notice of the M4 machine did Bletchley have? If you read the Hutt histories, and in particular Patrick Mahon's History of Hutt 8, he explicitly says that they knew what was coming.
The introduction of the fourth wheel did not catch us by surprise. The earliest mention of M4, as this machine was called, is in a captured document dated January 1941. Where instructions are given for adapting it to three-wheel keys. From this, it is clear that the machine must have been designed in 1940, or even before the war.
Extract from the History of Hutt 8 by A.P. Mahon, Patrick Mahon, head of Hutt 8, October 1944 to 1945.
You say read the History of Hutt 8. Where could we read this History of Hutt 8?
The History of Hutt 8 is actually available online.
Ah.
There's a website which contains it. So if you Google History of Hutt 8, The full text of it will come up. And there's a chapter entitled Shark. So you can read all about this in a lot more detail if you want to go and look it up.
Fantastic.
Basically, at the end of the war, they were worried that if another war happened, they'd have forgotten what they were doing and they'd have to reinvent it all again. So at the end of the war, all the different units wrote down what they'd done and what all the relevant techniques were. So for us historians, it's a brilliant resource that there's a history of Hut 8, there's a history of Hut 3, there's a history of Hut 6, there's a history of naval section, etc. And so history of Hut 8 specifically describes all of this stuff we're talking about. So Bletchley Park know from this previous captured documentary information that a four-rotor Enigma machine is likely to come along. The problem they have is that unless you know the wiring of the rotor, how the current, if the current comes in at A, which letter it goes out at, so to speak, unless you know the wiring of the rotor and the reflector, it's going to be really complicated to mimic it on a bomb machine or whatever else. So you need to understand the wiring. And this is where, we always come back to this, this is where human error comes in. Because these machines have been issued to U-boats in late 1941, but all the operators are using them as if they were three rotor machines. So they're keeping that rotor in the A position so that the thin rotor and the thin reflector mimic the old thick reflector. But in some cases, and there are a couple of incidents where the operator has accidentally knocked the rotor and it's not in the A position. And there's at least one case where the operator sends a message, which of course comes out the other end as complete gobbledygook.
Mm-hmm.
So he then clicks the rotor back to A.
Amazing. And resends the message
verbatim with the other three rotors in the same position. Absolutely classic.
Brilliant.
Cipher mistake. And through mistakes like that, Bletchley Park is able to sort of backtrack from the correct three rotor version they can understand to the gibberish version. And that tells them what the wiring of the rotor is.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So before it even comes into use, they already know what the rotor wiring is. It's like the Lorentz story all over again, this idea that if you get an operator that makes a mistake and then just resends things, it can be catastrophic. So, you know, you don't need very many people to make those kind of basic errors before you've completely worked out the wiring. And that's essentially what happens. By December 1941, they already completely understand the wiring of the rotor. So in a way, they're ready for this machine to be introduced. And they understand it. But as we've said many times, understanding how the machine works is not the same as being able to break it.
Yeah, particularly when it is so much more increasingly complex than the previous.
Yes, the key space is so much larger and everything else.
Yeah.
History has recorded who fired the first shot. In the long run, however, all that will matter is who fired the last shot. Our American merchant ships must be free to carry our American goods into the harbors of our friends. And our American merchant ships must be protected by our American Navy. I think that it can be said that it can never be doubted that the goods will be delivered by this nation whose Navy believes in the tradition of damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
So Bletchley Park has this new problem to face when the new system comes in. What extra challenges did they have to face with this new machine?
Well, there are a variety of different problems it presents. The first one is very simply that you have 26 times more settings possibilities. This is slightly reduced because something I didn't mention earlier, that thin rotor, the fourth rotor, is actually only changed once a month, whereas they change the settings of the other three every day. That one typically stays for a month. So if you can work it out, the times 26 part,
you're good for a month.
You're good
that
for
information.
A month.
Yeah.
But there are a number of other problems. One of the problems is simply the fact that there's now a separate key for Atlantic U-boats. Means that a lot fewer messages are being sent than were previously being sent on the entire network for all of the Navy. And techniques like Bamberismus, which was a technique that was developed to reduce the number of possible rotor choices in a machine, because when you've got 276 choices, Turing came up with a methodology with sheets of punched paper that allowed you to really narrow down the number of possible rotors in use. And that's vital because with a bomb machine, you don't want to have to run the bomb machine 60 times or 276 times. If you can reduce the number of rotors, you can do a lot fewer bomb runs But Bamberismus only works if you have a lot of messages to choose from, because you need particular messages with particular related settings. So if your pool of messages that you're intercepting is a lot smaller for that particular key, it meant firstly, Bamberismus just simply didn't work. But also, normal three-rotor Enigma breaking relies very heavily on cribs. So fewer messages, finding cribbable messages becomes more difficult.
A crib's a guessable
message. It's a guessable message that you can then compare the guessed plain text with the intercepted ciphertext. So just having fewer messages makes code breaking harder. And we have this rotor order issue that theoretically you could just, instead of doing what you do for a three-rotor Enigma message on a bomb machine, doing however many runs it takes to break a three-rotor message, you just do that 26 times. But the problem with that is it consumes all your bombs very, very quickly to break one message, because they would have to do multiple runs even with three-rotor. By the end of the war, they have 200 machines, but in 1942, they've only got fewer than 50 machines, so they've not got the bomb capacity that they had later. So it causes a lot of problems. But perhaps most fundamentally, and this is something we're going to talk about more in a minute, one of the major cribs that Bletchley Park was using was short signal books. Short signal books are a method of making messages shorter. The importance of that is, we've spoken previously about direction finding. This is the idea that if a U-boat pops its wireless aerial up and sends a message, and two places on the Earth, preferably quite far apart, can both hear that message at the same time and triangulate where the message is coming from, you can work out where the submarine is.
And the longer the submarine is transmitting.
The longer the submarine is transmitting for,
right,
the easier that becomes. So if the submarine or ship or whatever wireless transmitter it is can compress their message and make it as short as possible, then they greatly reduce the chance of firstly being intercepted at all, and secondly of being DF'd, as it's called, being direction found. And you find a lot of modern crypto systems, military systems, do what they call burst transmission, where you type all your message in or you create your message, and then the electronics mush it down into a really, really short burst of electronics. And then the machine at the other end kind of stretches back out again. That technology didn't exist at the time. So what the Germans had to come up with was a way of saying the things you'd need to say in a typical U-boat message in as few alphabetical letters as possible.
Like a code, basically.
Like a code, yeah. Yes. It is a code. Mm-hmm. What they have is a book which has letter groups, you know, pairs of letters or individual letters, that if you're a U-boat and you want to say, I'm in this position in the ocean, I've got this much fuel left, I've got this many torpedoes left, I attacked a merchant ship yesterday, it sank, you know, all of this information, you can look it up in this book, in a sort of dictionary of useful things a U-boat might want to say, the Kurzsignalheft it's called. And you go through there and you find the little two or three letter abbreviations that represent that information. And then you have to put those abbreviations in a certain order in your message. So you always say things in the same order. So you report, you know, what your fuel is may always come first, you know, how many torpedoes you've got come second, you know, your position comes third, whatever. But if you follow this system, you can end up with a message that is maybe only 15 or 20 characters, but expresses all of the things you want to say. As long as you don't want to say anything out of the ordinary, you know, if you've got to say, oh, you know, my wireless operator just had a baby. Mm-hmm. That you can't say that with a short signal book. But most of the things you want to say most of the time, you can then compress in this way. But the problem is, if the British have the short signal book, through a pinch or whatever, they can look at a U-boat message and go, right, we DF'd this guy to there. We think he left Lorient 2 weeks ago, so he's likely to have this much fuel on board. Mm. He's in this position. We know enough about him, and you know the book. You can then create a perfect crib of what he's probably said, and run that in your bomb machine, and it's 15 to 20 letters long. It's perfect length for a crib. Run that in your bomb machine, boom, out comes your daily key. So the short signal book is really, really vital for understanding naval messages. There's also a book, which is very important, called the Wetterkurzschlüssel, which is the short weather signal book. Mm-hmm. Because one of the other things U-boats commonly do is, because they're scattered all over the Atlantic, and most of our weather in Europe comes from the Atlantic, you get these weather systems tracking from the west. It's very convenient for the Germans, for all sorts of reasons, to know the weather. And the great way to know the weather is if you have U-boats out in the Atlantic sending you temperature, pressure, wind direction, sea state, all the kind of weather information you'd want. And the Wetterkurzschlüssel allows them to do that in exactly the same way, that there's little abbreviations that say temperature, sea state, seawater temperature, all the weather things you want to know. And those messages are being used as cribs as well, because the British have a pretty good idea of what the weather is. The big blow is that if four-rotor Enigma had arrived for Naval Section and for Bletchley Park, life would have been 26 times more difficult, but you still would have had the cribs from the short signal books. Unfortunately, the Germans in January 1942 changed the short signal books as well.
So all changed, new machine, new books.
So even for the three rotor traffic, which U-boats in the Arctic and the Mediterranean and surface ships are using, those short signal cribs have suddenly gone.
So even if Bletchley Park had an idea that this new machine might come in, this is a huge, well, it's a huge blow, like you say. It's suddenly everything stops.
It's a massive setback. And the result is that while Naval Section are still able to read Enigma messages from U-boats in other parts of the world, I'm doing a lot of work on the Arctic at the moment, and through the summer of 1942, they're still reading Enigma messages in the Arctic because they're still on the old Dolphin three-rotor network. But messages in the Atlantic become unreadable. The light goes out and they can't read anything. It's not a complete lack of intelligence because they're still able to do the direction finding, they're still able to do traffic analysis, they're still able to gain information about U-boats, and they can still do their plotting. But the way Patrick Beasley talks about it in his book about the Operational Intelligence Center and the Admiralty is he says the picture just got progressively more blurred. You know, their understanding of what's going on becomes more fuzzy in general because they're not able to read the messages. And it's not until the autumn, until November, that they actually find a way to solve the problem.
We're now mixed up in, I think I'm right in saying, the first attack on a convoy which has been actually recorded at sea. We've been attacked by bombers. There have been two runs over the convoy as yet. All the ships have been just blazing off like mad. They've put a stick of bombs, but so far no damage has been done. So I've taken up a position by the gun in the stern. It's a 12-pounder, and I'm right amidst the gun crew now. The shells all around me, too, and more are being handed up from the magazine below. I expect you can hear the crew. And wait a minute. Here he comes. He's on our port quarter, not much more than 500 feet up, I should say, and just about abreast of us now. There are tracer bullets bursting all around him. He's crossing a stern straight over, but you can still follow him through this night cloud. And there go his bombs. There are six or four of them. They're hanging in the air for a moment. I can see them distinctly, and now they're dropping down over the convoy. But wait a minute. He's missed. Columns of water sprouting up, but he's missed. The ships are still there, and it looks as if we're all right. There's just a faint smell of gunpowder and smoke drifting across the water, but we won't worry about that. He's missed, and everything's okay.
The Atlantic U-boat threat, as we know, was devastating, but did this have a significant impact on that as well? The lack of ability to read German traffic, can that be seen to have translated into a greater number of attacks, for example, on convoys?
Yes, yes. I mean, the Battle of the Atlantic isn't just a homogenous process where each part of it is the same, where you've got U-boats sailing around the Atlantic looking for convoys. It has different stages where the Germans use different tactics. In the first part of 1942, America has just entered the war in December 1941, and you have what the Germans refer to as the first happy time. And the reason they call it a happy time is because Dönitz sends a lot of U-boats to the immediate coastal areas of the United States. And there are convoys moving up and down the American coast before heading north on the Great Circle route that takes them up past Newfoundland and across the Atlantic. Also, there's a lot of ships coming up from the Caribbean because you've got oil coming from the Caribbean and all sorts of other useful things. And initially, the Americans don't convoy these ships. So the American coast has lots of very, very vulnerable individual merchant ships sailing up and down. And the U-boats, it's a free-for-all. They sink ridiculous numbers of ships. And it's a big shock to the Americans. I mean, the way some of the U-boat commanders describe it was the Americans didn't even have a blackout on the coast. And the merchant ships are sailing right inshore. So if you're a U-boat, you stand out at sea and your merchant ship will be completely silhouetted against the lights of the towns on the beach.
Yeah.
They just sail in front of you.
Goodness.
So in the early part of 1942, there's a lot of U-boats operating individually off the coast of the US. And reading or not reading their messages doesn't make a huge difference because, A, it's a bit of a disaster anyway, but also because their boats are operating independently. In the later part of the year, sort of from the midsummer onwards, the Germans go back to attacking the traditional convoy routes in the middle of the Atlantic, in what's called the Atlantic Air Gap, because you have reconnaissance aircraft that can protect the convoys from Canada on one side and Iceland and the UK on the other side, but there's a space in between because the aircraft can't fly far enough. The Germans go back to attacking convoys with wolf packs in the air gap. And the point about wolf pack attacks is you get one U-boat that will find a convoy, and then rather than attacking straight away, he'll wait and he'll summon lots of other submarines, and you'll get, you know, a dozen submarines will all come up. And when they've all got there, they all attack at once. And that is vastly more difficult for the escort ships to defend, and it's a really effective way of using submarines. But it involves a lot of radio traffic, because they've all got to chat away with one another, and they've all got to be coordinated from Paris and all the rest of it. So once, during the summer, they go back to wolf pack attacks on the convoy routes, not reading their traffic becomes a real big deal. And again, there's a spike in the graph because more and more merchant ships get sunk. So it's becoming a real big issue for naval section in a way that it wasn't necessarily so much in the spring. That's a very long answer to a simple question, but the pressure is really on them.
Bomb machines were used to attack messages encrypted with the M1, the M2, the M3. Were bomb machines the solution that Bletchley Park came up with to attack the M4?
Yes and no.
Okay.
yes, in the long term, although you still need the cribs, a good solution would be to have a 26 times faster bomb machine with four rotors on it that matched the four rotors on the M4 machine. And that is what Bletchley set about doing. As early as the summer of 1941, May 1941, because they've already established that this machine is going to come into use at some point, or that's 6 months before it does, they already start going, right, we need to think about a four-rotor bomb machine.
When you say four-rotor bomb machine, what do you mean by that? Because we know there's loads of rotors on a bomb machine.
Yes. A typical bomb machine has three banks of 36, and each bank is 12 columns of three drums, as they call them. Each of those columns of three drums represents the three rotors in an Enigma machine. Putting it very simply, each column of three drums represents an Enigma machine at the setting that would be used for one letter of your crypt.
And then you've got across a bank of those.
Across a bank.
And then you've got two
others. And then
others.
Typically the machines have three banks of rotors. And quite often, if you had a long crib, you could run it over several lines. Or if you had a 12-letter crib, you could use different rotor orders on each bank.
Right.
So of the possible 60, you could do three on one machine, for example.
So when you say a four-rotor bomb, is that like adding another row?
It's basically adding another row of drums. Mm-hmm. Basically, the bomb machine is imagining a whole series of Enigma machines wired to each other. So each column of drums mimics the functioning of one Enigma machine. Mm-hmm. So you've got 36 Enigma machines all wired together, essentially, is what the machine is. So to produce a bomb machine for M4 Enigma, you'd need four drums in each
column.
In
or each machine.
In each machine, in inverted commas. And you go, yeah, you can add another row of drums. But the problem you have is that because the fourth drum on the bomb machine has to turn through all 26 positions, and it only moves when the other drums have all done their thing. A normal three-rotor bomb machine can get through all 17,560 settings in about 10, 15 minutes. But if it had to have a fourth drum and it went at the same speed, it would take 26 times longer. So it would take 260 minutes, mm-hmm. which is what, more than 4 hours. So in order for a four-drum bomb machine to work, you need to make the rotors go around faster.
Or it'd just take ages just to do a single run, which might not even be successful.
So in an ideal world, if you want one bomb run to take the same amount of time as it does on a three-drum bomb machine, the fastest spinning drum needs to go around 26 times faster.
Right.
And already on a three-rotor machine, it's going around pretty fast.
So it actually becomes a mechanical issue that needs to be solved
as well. It becomes an engineering challenge, yes. Yeah. And the second difficulty is, British Tabulating Machines in Letchworth, who are the company who are building bomb machines, already flat out building three-rotor bomb machines. And the problem of Army Air Force Enigma has not gone away. Mm-hmm. You still need as many three-rotor machines as you can get. This is just an added problem piled on top. The Germans haven't switched away from what they were doing before. They've added an extra system. So they do need additional machines. And the first solution they have is they go, right, well, Doc Keane and the guys at BTM are working flat out with three-rotor machines. It's probably best to let them do their thing. And we'll find a different company to separately take on the four-rotor problem.
Because there's this new challenge of the super fast.
Yeah. So they go, right, we'll see who else we've got. Sir Edward Appleton, who was the secretary of the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, so he's the guy in charge of bombs and everything else, suggests a place called the Telecommunications Research Establishment, the TRE, that was, by this point, it was in Malvern, near Worcester. Their main job up to this point has been radar, and they went on to be big in radar after the war as well. So they are high-tech government contractor, basically. And there's a company called Maudsley & Co. who are in Dursley in Gloucestershire, which is not that far from Malvern. It's sort of down the road. And Maudsley are building equipment that TRE has designed. So they say, right, here's the four-rotor problem. Why don't you go and solve it?
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy called Charles Wynne Williams, who is, as his name implies, Welsh. Like so many people at Bletchley, he's a former Cambridge physicist. He worked at Imperial College as well. And he's working at TRE doing radar things and other technological problems. And they say to him, here's the four-rotor bomb problem. He goes, right, we can solve that. What we'll do is we'll get the standard three-rotor machine and we'll develop the fourth rotor, the fourth drum part of the problem, as a separate machine.
So it won't sit on a row below. It's literally an entirely separate.
Completely separate machine that you plug in, so or you connect up to your three-drum machine.
Mm-hmm.
And he builds a thing called Cobra, a high-speed commutator. And what this is basically is this is the set of drums that need to go round fastest for the machine to be practical. So it's the equivalent of the right-hand rotor on the Enigma machine. But those drums have to spin really, really fast. And the problem is not just making them go round and keeping a consistent electrical contact while they go round, but at every one of the 26 positions of the drum as it's spinning, you have to do an electrical test to see whether that's the setting you want or not. And on the conventional machine, the normal bomb machine, that test is done by an electrical relay, which is a basic little mechanical switch where you get an electric current and it kind of goes tick. But the problem is that those relays have a maximum speed at which they'll go tick. So if you spin the drum too fast, the relay doesn't have time to operate in the short window of time when the circuit is made with each of the connections.
Mm-hmm.
You're still with me on this?
Yeah,
one?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And this is where another character that we're quite familiar with, Tommy Flowers at the post office, Dollis Hill, comes in.
When the war started in 1939 and all civil work had to be subordinated to war work, no longer could we do what we liked, but we had to do what we were told. And what I was told to do in 1941 was to go to Bletchley Park and to receive some top secret work. By good luck, I was about to be involved in choke breaking, and this would provide an opportunity for the immediate application of the work which I had done pre-war, something which might not have happened, in fact didn't happen, for a whole generation after the war. Cryptanalysts at Bletchley Park had succeeded from the early days of the war in reading German secret messages which had been encoded on a machine called an Enigma. Alan Turing, a name well known in computer circles, was taking a leading part in this work, and it was he who explained it to me when I got to Bletchley Park and what the post office was required to do. And what the post office was required to do was, using telephone switches and techniques, make some machines which were equivalent to the Enigma coding machines, but could work much faster. Two other Dollis Hill engineers were to be allowed to share the secrets of Bletchley Park. They were Sidney Broadhurst, who regrettably died a few months ago, and Bill Chandler, who is here this afternoon. But otherwise, the purpose of the machines was to be kept secret from everybody else. In the 3 months that it took us to make the first machine and get it into operation, it was realised that the machines weren't really wanted. They were not required. And had that been realised earlier, and there was some suspicion that it might have been, that their planning probably was a bit faulty, then Dollis Hill might never have been involved with Bletchley Park, and the course of the war could have been different, although not its final result. But we were there and available when the next big problem turned up, which required engineering assistance.
And if it's Tommy Flowers, he's going to be talking about valves.
Yes.
And he says, well, if you can get a machine that can make the high-speed electrical contacts, I'll manufacture what he calls a valve sensing unit, which is using valves instead of relays. And these valves will trip quick enough that they can keep up with the speed that the rotor's going around. And so you've got three parts of the machine. You've got an old-fashioned bomb in the middle. You've got Cobra at one end, providing the spinning fourth drum. And at the other end, you've got the valve-based system doing the test, checking whether it's the right setting. And this is the solution that TRE and the GPO come up with. The long and short of it is it doesn't work very well.
It feels like there's a lot that could go wrong with it. It's very complex.
It's very complicated. One of the key problems they have is, and this is a problem even with the normal bomb machines, that making a reliable electrical contact with one component that's spinning and one that's staying still, the few fractions of a second that contact is made, it's got to be made absolutely reliably, because if it skips one or it bounces over one or whatever and you miss a setting, you could miss the one setting you actually need. And the Cobra machines that provide this high-speed drum are spinning at such high speed that the technology really doesn't work. And part of the problem is the contacts wear very quickly and they generate a lot of dust, graphite dust that comes off the contacts. And the few that they actually install, they have to install them in a separate room from the regular bomb machines.
Wow.
Because the dust generated by the spinning of the Cobra wheels would get into the bomb doing the other three drums.
Which is very sensitive.
Which is very sensitive in its own right. So the contacts would get dust in them and it would knacker the whole thing.
It also feels like however good Flower's valve sensing unit is, it's going to be stymied by the actual physical issues faced by the Cobra.
Yes. And GCNCS don't want to put all their eggs in one basket. So they go back to Doc Keane at British Tabulating Machines and say, can you ever think about this at the same time? Doc Keane, I think he's a really underestimated guy because he's a very clever engineer, amongst other things. And he looks at it and he goes, right, I could build a four-drum bomb exactly the same as my three-drum bomb. All I need is a relay that will tick on and off faster than any relay yet invented. And so he invents a relay, which is about 16 times faster than the existing relays. And once he's developed that, he says, right, if I put those relays in a four-drum machine, it won't spin 25 times faster, but it'll spin 16 times faster and still work, which is good enough.
So a run will take longer.
It will take a little bit longer, but it won't take, you know, crazily longer. Mm-hmm. And the virtue of that is you can build it into a version of the existing technology. You can use the same drum designs. You can use the same basic structure of the machine. You just put a fourth row of drums on it and equip the whole thing with faster relays. And you get a machine that is much, much closer to the old three rotor machines. And in many ways, a lot simpler. It's not this machine plugged to this machine, plugged to this machine and everything else. The problem is, at this point, you have two rival teams, both trying to produce machines. Everybody's under massive pressure. Shark's not being read. You know, we need to solve this problem really fast. And both sides are going, our machine's brilliant. Our machine will solve it. Give us more money. Give us more resources. And Gordon Welshman, who's head of mechanization at Bletchley Park, is in the middle of this kind of going, what do I do? And the relationship gets really, really awkward between the varying personalities, between Wynne Williams and Tommy Flowers and Doc Keane. And Welshman's in the middle. All he wants is a machine that works. The climax of this, in a way, is that Tommy Flowers has his valve sensing unit up and running, and he says, all I need now is a bomb machine, and I can plug my valve sensing unit into it and show that it'll work. So rather reluctantly, Bletchley Park take a bomb machine out of circulation, which they would normally be using to break keys.
And they're needing it right now. The demand is really high.
And they say, okay, Tommy, you can borrow this machine to test your gadget. It's given to the post office, and it doesn't work. The valve sensing unit doesn't work. And the post office come back and go, this bomb machine's broken. And Welshman's going, well, it wasn't broken when we gave it to you. And there's this kind of schoolboy argument going, well, it was broken when you gave it to us. No, it wasn't. No. We haven't broken it. It was already broken. Everything gets a bit unpleasant. And then Flowers and his team start accusing Welshman of bias and saying, you've hated us from the start. You've always been favourable to Doc Keane and his team. And it's just, you know, there's so much professional jealousy going on. It all gets a bit ugly.
And this is all in the historical record. You've read letters back and forth.
I mean, the wonderful thing about Gordon Welshman is he likes nothing better than to write a 5-page memo. So if you go into HW14 for the summer of 1942...
This is the records in the National Archives.
All of these 5-page memos from Gordon Welshman to Travis are in there going, I've had another meeting with the four-rotor bomb people.
I roll.
And there's a point where Flowers and Wynne Williams make direct accusations about the BTM team being, you know, charlatans and fraudsters and all this sort of thing. And they have to write a formal letter apologising and taking back the things they said in the meeting. So, you know, it's good fun because Bletchley Park is so often presented as this really collaborative, really sort of friendly, everyone's working to the same end and it's a marvellous thing. Actually, it's full of big egos and humans, just the same as any other large organisation. And if you talk to Tom about the admin as well, you'll see the same story, that there's any number of times when people at Bletchley Park are falling out with one another over quite big issues. And Dilly Knox, of course, we know, fell out with everybody all the time.
True, so, yeah.
It does dispel that myth of happy cooperation somewhat. The result of it is that although they do run 12 of the so-called Wynne-Williams machines, they only ever build 12. And that's kind of to shut Tommy Flowers up. They go, yeah, we'll have some of your machines and we'll use them. But they don't build any more. And Doc Keane produces his HSK, his high-speed Keane machine, as it's called, which is a four-drum bomb machine using relays. And they build a much larger number of those. They build, I think it's over 50 of those. So they do ultimately get a British bomb, but that doesn't happen until June of 1943. So 15 months, 16 months after the shark problem has first arisen, you finally get a bomb machine.
Wow, that's a huge amount of time.
Almost a year and a half when they don't have the tech. They have been doing work on the old machines, but it's not very good. So yes, the answer is ultimately to build a bespoke bomb machine. But that's not the answer in January 1942. It's not even the answer in November 1942. It kind of becomes the answer in the middle of 1943. And, you know, something needed to be done before then.
It's also nice to be able to pay tribute a bit to Harold Keane. We talk about quite often the Turing-Welshman bomb, this invention where Alan Turing and Gordon Welshman, who obviously fundamental to its design, but Harold Keane had so much input, not into just this, as we've been talking about, the four-drum high-speed Keane, but the bomb itself, right from the start, its invention, its creation, its construction.
Absolutely. I think Keane is one of those people that really deserves more credit than he gets. And I think he is one of the kind of unsung heroes, as you say. Because the point about Turing and, to a certain extent, Gordon Welshman is they're mathematicians, they're not engineers. And Turing, on several occasions, decides to build physical machines that are manifestations of some of his mathematical ideas. He never completes any of them because he's not a very good engineer. He's a brilliant mathematician. What you need is somebody who knows how to wire relays and grind gears and make physical things. And Doc Keane is exactly that man. And Tommy Flowers plays a similar role with Robinson and Colossus in the sense that he doesn't invent the concept.
Mm.
It's a mathematical thing that's developed by Turing and Tutte, but he is the engineer who makes the idea a reality.
Yeah, brings it to fruition and makes it to fruition.
And he gets a lot of credit for that in terms of Colossus and Robinson. But exactly the same role is played by Keane for the bomb, which arguably generates vastly more intelligence, but he just doesn't seem to get a shout, which is a shame. So it's nice to sort of name check it.
Absolutely.
And his idea of like, oh, well, all you need is a faster relay. I'll just design one of those. I think he's fantastic, you know.
In the defence of Britain and in the keeping open of our lifeline of supply with America is the way to our victory. Mr. Churchill said that we're taking all possible measures to meet the deadly attack in the Atlantic. The Battle of the Atlantic holds first place in the thoughts of those upon whom rests the responsibility for procuring the victory. And the Premier paid a well-deserved tribute to the Navy and the Air Force and to the Merchant Navy, whose great task it is to win this decisive battle. Hitler has loosed the whole weight of his U-boat force against our lifeline in the Atlantic, but the Navy is taking its toll. These are the latest prisoners, but there are many, many more who are out of the fight, though not by capture.
Am I right in thinking that some of these four-drum bombs were built in the USA as well?
Yes.
Why was that? Why were they built all the way over there?
Well, it's kind of a coincidence. As we've said, at the beginning of 1942, or December 1941, the US entered the war against Germany after Pearl Harbor. And even prior to that, through the summer of 1941, the Americans have been very keen to keep up with Enigma developments. And so we have the Sinkoff visit in February 1941. And from that point on, the Americans want to know as much as they can about Enigma. And the British were the same about what the Americans were doing. They absolutely want to keep up to speed with any of the latest crypto developments. They really want the knowledge, even if they're not going to do much with it. So throughout 41, they are leaning on Bletchley saying, oh, can we have more information about the bomb machines? Can we have an actual bomb machine? And things like that. The British are very reluctant to give them a bomb machine because they need all they can get. So they're kind of pushing back against the Americans and going, no, you don't need to know that yet. We're dealing with that. But the pressure builds and builds. And Denniston himself actually goes to the US in August 1941, and he writes, perhaps the most important purpose of the visit is to clear up the position concerning e-traffic, which means Enigma, and this pressure from the US to share technology with them. Eventually, in April 1942, once Shark has come in, John Tiltman is in the US, and he comes back and he basically tells Bletchley Park, we need to share this technology with the Americans because they're really kind of getting quite huffy about it now, and you know, we need to bring them in on the story. And so Initially, the Americans are promised a bomb machine, which they never get. But more importantly, two Americans, Robert Ely and Joseph Ekus from the US Navy, come to Bletchley in July 1942. And they're given blueprints of bomb machines and shown the machines and given the whole nine yards, really. Joe Ekus is quite important in the wider Bletchley story because he marries Barbara Abernathy, who was Denison's original secretary from the Sinkov visit in 1941. And she becomes Barbara Ekus and goes on to go to the Washington and have a whole separate story of her own. So the Americans have got all this knowledge about bombs and they want to get involved. And the obvious thing at that point is, what do we need? Well, we don't need more three-rotor bombs because we've kind of got BTM making those.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get the Americans doing four-rotor machines. And also because the US Navy is in charge of the US bomb program, their interest isn't in German Army Air Force. Their interest is in naval traffic. Their interest specifically is in Atlantic U-boats because that's what the US Navy is fighting at that point. They're escorting convoys and they're involved in the Battle of the Atlantic. So in September 42, Joseph Wenger, who is the head of an outfit called Op 20G, who are the code breakers in the US Navy, basically, he says, right, we've got enough information from the British. Let's have our own bomb program. And he gets a $2 million budget to do. I mean, $2 million in 1942 is quite a lot of money. And in the same way that Britain went to BTM, he goes to NCR, the National Cash Register Company in Dayton, Ohio, and sets them about designing a four-rotor bomb machine. Had Shark not come along, they could quite conceivably have built a three-rotor bomb machine. But actually, at this point, it makes a lot more sense to attack the four-rotor problem. And that's what they do. And they develop a machine that is in some ways similar to the British machine, but it's actually more advanced because it uses a lot more electronic technology rather than sort of physically revolving drums to do a lot of the work. So it is a step ahead of the British machine. But it's based on a lot of the same ideas. And indeed, Alan Turing travels to Dayton in December 1942 to talk to Joe Desch, who's the guy who's in charge of the American project. Interestingly enough, Joe Desch only has one spare bedroom in his house, and the US Navy liaison officer is already sleeping in there. So Alan Turing has to sleep on the mattress on the living room floor when he goes to stay. But Turing turns up and they have a good long chat about four-rotor bomb machines, and the Americans get their machines built. And by May 1943, the first machines start rolling off their production line. Initially, they actually start running them in the corridors of the factory in Dayton, because the facility they're going to move them to in Washington, D.C. hasn't been finished yet. The U.S. Navy take over an old girls' school in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. as their naval communications annex, and they build purpose-built buildings to put all these bombs in. But the first bombs arrive, and there isn't a roof on the building. So they put them in the ground floor, and the top floor, it still doesn't have a roof. But they get it going. And what that means is by August of 1943, the U.S. also have four-rotor bomb machines up and running. They ultimately build just over 100.
Wow.
Initially, when they put the contract out, they said, well, there's 336 possible rotor orders, so let's build 336 bomb machines.
That's bold. Goodness.
It is bold. And Turing comes along and goes, I don't think you actually need to do that. You can probably get away with about 90, you know. So they build fewer than they originally planned. But they, again, like the British, they build them right up till more or less May 1945.
Mm.
And interestingly, it mirrors the British operation in the same way that instead of having wrens, they have waves. Women accepted for voluntary emergency service in the US Navy. So a wave is the US equivalent of a wren. And there's a whole separate social history. Like we talk about the bomb operators here in the UK, there's a whole team of female bomb operators in Naval Communications Annex in Washington, D.C. There's a book about them actually called Code Girls, which is an American historian has written, telling that sort of parallel story. So there's a big US bomb operation over there. And actually, once the US operation gets going, by the middle of 1944, when they've got a reasonable number of machines running, they have enough capacity to take over Shark completely. So the British stop building HSK machines and they go back to building the old three-rotor machines that they need for the Army and the Air Force traffic, because there's enough capacity in Washington to do everything they need for the U-boats.
So this is a symbol of real cooperation between the Allies.
Yes.
They sort of split the task.
Yeah, they've split the task up. But you're talking mid-1944, and we're talking the introduction of Shark is January 1942. So It takes a long time. They get there in the end. And arguably, by the middle of 1944, the Battle of the Atlantic is in its death throes. The U-boat campaign against the convoys is vastly less effective than it was previously. And all sorts of other technologies have come in. Airborne radar that can detect U-boat periscopes. Better air cover, the airplanes that can fill the gap in the middle of the Atlantic, you know. So there's all sorts of other technologies that are beating the U-boats anyway. And it's arguable that by the time four-rotor bomb machines become a real factor, the Germans have kind of already lost in the Atlantic. So the bombs come in quite late. But there is a separate code-breaking effort which happens sooner, which is of much more significance.
And what is that?
This is pinches. We go back to capturing German material from ships. I described earlier how in May 1941, the first breaks into three-rotor naval Enigma are achieved because of pinches.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, pinches of those short signal books that I was talking about, which can be used for cribs. And examples of those books were captured in particular from U-110, which was a U-boat that was actually surfaced and then was captured by HMS Bulldog in the Atlantic in May 1941. And we know about that incident in detail because we were able to interview Arnold Hargreaves a few years ago, who was actually a member of the boarding party on U-110.
Can you lead us up to what happened? So you were on a convoy.
Ships are getting sunk, all right. Then they ping, ping, ping through, and they've got a contact with a submarine, all right.
So the submarine comes up, and the captain asks for a boarding party, does he?
He didn't ask you, say you.
Well, orders a boarding party. So how many were there of you?
In the ship, because it's a guns crew, I think there must have been 5 to 7 blokes in the guns crew, captain the gun and doers, and it comes through on the earphones, ex-gun man the whaler. So we had to drop everything, all scrambled down onto the whaler. I think there must have been 20 or 25 people to lower it. So clear lower deck for lowering the whaler, all right? So all the seamen that weren't doing any special job, up to manhandle these. Then you're on your own then it's man the oars. Then there's me and the other blokes are rowing away to the U-boat.
So at this point, the U-boat surfaced, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's damaged. And are the crew jumping out?
They're jumping out, some of them. But they was all jumped out on the lee side of the submarine here. And as we come up like this here, we had to get on board. Someone scrambled on board there, and a few more scrambled on board there. Then as they was messing about on the submarine, like we, all of us, this here boat was still nobody in it. And the waves coming along there, bashed it and bashed it and bashed it, sunk, smashed the whaler. And so no transport, see?
Before they told you to board, did you have any idea what you were going to do?
Nothing, just go and take it over as a salvage or tow it into harbour. So we're getting a few bits and pieces and that together. And where that's gone, your transport's gone. Yeah. I said, how much is that? Can you swim? I said, now's your chance to learn them. So I think that they had another contact with another submarine. The Bulldog cleared off. We was on a Jack Jones on there. Of course, another submarine might be trying to torpedo us because they must have a periscope somewhere watching what we were doing. So we all got in there getting bits and pieces and getting bags.
Who led the boarding party?
Lieutenant
Baum.
Baum, that's the bloke.
David Baum.
Yeah, David Baum, yeah. He was in charge of us.
Yeah. So did he say anything to you what to look for? Did he just say grab anything?
Just everything we got. Just fill your bags up, see? Well, what happened was we got all the stuff there, but no transport, all right. There's another destroyer, and they lowered their boat. It was a motor launch. When we got all the gear, they did all the moving from the submarine to the Bulldog. When all the gear was on the Bulldog, it had bags like...
canvas sacks, were they?
Yeah. So most of them tipped all the stuff on the mess deck table. Yeah, help yourself. The bloke said, well, I love that. I love that. I love that. I've even got tin out here as well. Got the lamp here. Got sword here. Got hat here.
What, all from U-110?
Yes. Clocks and things and watches and medals and all in the country somewhere. Nobody's asked for them.
When you were inside the U-boat, it was literally anything you could pick up, you put in a bag.
False teeth or whatever it is.
So you weren't just looking for...
No, just that was coming handy, that would come, like the tin out, you know, yeah. Put it in there. Oh, a lot of little knickknacks, you know, watches or...
So do you know who pinched the Enigma?
That bloke,
David Baum. Yeah. Commander Baum.
He's a bloke. He was a bloke of more intelligent, that's
sub-lieutenant, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a more intelligent role.
So if we go back to when you were at sea, so the initial idea was to tow the U-boat to port, wasn't it?
We towed it for about 3 days with a rope. I think it was a rope, it wouldn't be a cable, because there was a bloke there with a hacksaw ready to chop the wire in case it was sinking.
Yeah.
And it would have us as well, more or less. In the end, towed it for 3 days, it sunk. And from there, it's another job, another convoy.
Thanks to Arnold and his chums, Bletchley Park has these short signal books. And I was explaining how useful these were in breaking Enigma generally, as well as four-rotor Enigma. The problem is that the weather short signal book is replaced in January 1942, and then the more general Kurtz signal heft is also replaced, so these cribs disappear. Prior to that, what Bletchley Park has been doing, this is quite complicated, but it's also very clever. When the German U-boat sends a short weather signal, this goes back to Germany and is decoded from its little groups of letters, and they get the weather forecast. That information is then included in a broadcast that a German wireless station in Nordeich, which used the call sign DAN, so Bletchley Park referred to them as DAN messages. These DAN messages are weather forecasts that are sent out to everybody.
Not in this.
It's not in the short weather code. What they've done is they've decrypted the information from the U-boats, and they've taken all sorts of other weather information from other places.
Right.
And they're giving just a weather forecast for all the German armed forces. This is what the weather's going to be, the Navy in particular. And they have a separate code called GERMET3, so-called because it's German. It's a meteorological code, and it uses three-letter groups, so GERMET3. And what they do is they take all of their weather forecast information, put it in GERMET3, send it out to anyone that needs to know the weather. This is where we come to Hut 10 at Bletchley Park. And Hut 10 at Bletchley Park is the meteorological section.
A section we don't speak about often enough.
And the Met section, what they specialise in doing is breaking the specialist codes that are used for German weather forecasts. And what they realise in conjunction with Naval section is that if you break GERMET, you can get the plain text of the weather forecast. And this was done in a process called archery. The reason it's called archery is because the head of meteorological section was a chap called Philip Archer. So in traditional Bletchley Park fashion, it's done by a guy called Archer. They call it archery, like Turingery and Herivalismus. And, you know, Bletchley Park likes a pun. So you have archery. And what they do is once they've figured out what the plain text of the weather forecast is, they can read through that weather forecast and spot the sections of it that have come from a U-boat. So if buried in there is information about the weather in the Atlantic in a particular location, they can go, oh, right, that's from a U-boat. So they then use their own copy, the Bletchley Park copy of the short weather signal book, to reconstruct what the message from the U-boat would have been to create that bit of the weather forecast, which has been sent out in GERMET. And then they use that as a crib to find out the key of shark.
And people claim that information about the weather isn't important. It's really important.
It's fundamental.
Key here.
It's an extraordinary idea that you go by breaking that code over there about something that doesn't seem terribly important. You can then reverse engineer that code back into the short signal book and then use that to get the key from the U-boat. It's an extraordinary code breaking exercise.
Genius.
But the problem with it is just when you need it most, when shark has been introduced, the Germans change the book.
It feels like they really need one of these new books.
This is where luck comes in. In October 1942, because in October 1942, a second U-boat is captured. We've heard about U-110, this is U-559. It's forced to the surface in the Mediterranean, sort of north of Alexandria, by HMS Petard. And we have an exhibition about it, a small exhibition about it here at Bletchley Park. And part of the reason we're talking about shark today is because 30th of October 1942, 80 years ago, this is the anniversary of what's known as the Petard Pinch, the capture of short signal books from U-559.
Dawn, 30th of October, 1942. A periscope and the outline of a submarine are spotted by a Royal Air Force patrol aircraft in the eastern Mediterranean. This sighting will be a vital turning point at Bletchley Park. HMS Petard and three other warships are on the scene by 10 a.m. and spend the next 10 hours hunting and depth charging the U-boat. Night has fallen when the submarine is finally forced to surface after sustaining serious damage. Chaotic scenes unfold as the enemy crew start to abandon ship. Knowing the U-boat could contain vital intelligence which could be utilized by the Allies, Tony Fasson, the first lieutenant on Petard, and able seaman Colin Grazier immediately leap into the sea and swim through a mass of fleeing U-boat men towards the U-559. They are followed by Naffy canteen assistant Tommy Brown. Cold and wet, Fasson and Grizzy aboard the submarine, climbing down the conning tower into the blackness below.
One of the poignant aspects of the capture of U-559 is, whereas on U-110, they were able to board the submarine, and the submarine stayed afloat for some time, and they were able to thoroughly ransack it. The boarding party that go on to U-559 have a really difficult job. The submarine is already sinking when they go in, and it's filling up with water. And one of the problems you have is the moment the water gets on the batteries in a submarine, if you get seawater on batteries, it produces chlorine gas. So the interior of the submarine is filling up with water. You know, all the toilets are backed up. All the rations have fallen off the shelves. There's dead bodies in there. There's chlorine gas. And two naval officers, Fasson and Grazier, go down into the ship. And they're in the signals office, ransacking it, getting books. And they're passing stuff up the conning tower. And at the top of the conning tower is a young chap called Tommy Brown, who's actually he doesn't work for the Navy at all. He works for the Naffy. And he should be working in the canteen on HMS Petard. But he's managed to find his way onto a boat and get across to U-559. So he's heaving these things out and passing them to some chaps in a rowing boat next to the submarine. And eventually he has to jump off because the submarine just sinks. And unfortunately, Fasson and Grazier are still in the hull of the submarine when it sinks, and they're both killed. They're awarded the George Cross for their efforts. But the material they've passed up is absolute gold, because the moment Bletchley Park can get a new weather signal book, in this case, they can go back to looking for those cribs. And the other really key point about the short signal books is that because there's not a separate short signal book for Shark, the same short signal book is used by other U-boats using old three-rotor systems. So when you send a short weather signal, you set your rotor to A and you use your machine with only a three-rotor setting. So all of a sudden, the keys have become really accessible, because not only do you have the crib from the book because you've read the Germet signal and you've got the weather, but also it's only a three-rotor setting. That book turns up at Bletchley in the back end of October, early November. It takes a couple of weeks to make its way from the Eastern Mediterranean to Buckinghamshire. But once it gets here, it's absolute gold, and it allows Bletchley Park to, as they put it, break back into Shark. And it's only a couple of weeks later in November where they're able to send a signal to the Operational Intelligence Centre in the Admiralty saying, here's 15 U-boats that we've identified all of a sudden. From having this completely blurred map, this completely out of focus map, suddenly, bam, you've got the positions of all of these submarines. And that's really, really crucial, because in the spring of 1943, Dönitz makes a renewed effort against the convoys. He sends his submarines back into the Central Atlantic. Wolfpack attacks start again. And reading the messages to those submarines is absolutely crucial. Strikingly, there is a point in March when the Germans change their weather book again, and so Bletchley lose the opportunity to use that book. But they do have the other short signal, the general short signal book, the Kurzsignalheft. They have the new edition of that as well. And so they go to breaking using that as cribs. And that also uses a three-rotor setting. So they can use that book. There are a couple of convoys in March 1943 that are famous for suffering very heavy losses, because there's about a fortnight where there is a blackout, and unfortunately it happens just at the moment when the Germans are making a big effort. But they go from using what they call the WW messages, weather messages, to these what they call B-bar messages, which are the short signal messages. And those two techniques between October 1942 and the summer of 1943, when the four-rotor bombs start coming in, they provide the sort of bridge of decryption ability between those two moments. And that spring of 1943 is really, really critical for the U-boat war.
As our convoys pass to and fro, U-boats lurk in the vast waters, preparing to cut our lifelines at every opportunity. In a recent instance, it was a case of the biter bit. German planes and U-boats attacked one of our convoys of over 30 ships, but the Navy, as ever, was on its toes. Before one could say, "Hell, Hitler," the escorting warships closed in around their precious charges and proceeded to teach the Nazis a lesson. With a ringside seat on one of our destroyers was an amateur cameraman who secured short flashes of the U-boats in the thick of the trouble they asked for. The photographic quality is poor, but they are the real thing. At this moment, the U-131 has taken a jab from a depth charge, while our destroyers are hunting two other U-boats, the U-434 and the 574. They've all been hit. Those blobs in the water are survivors from the U-boats, in the very soup in which they had hoped to see British sailors. So let's not waste sympathy on them. Yes, the Royal Navy can be relied upon to do its job.
What's striking about this period of decryption using the short signal books is that it's not one person's effort. It's not just one guy in naval section coming up with a solution. You've got all the people in Met section doing their thing. You've got the people in naval section doing their thing. You've got DF people working out where the submarine is in the first place so that you can match it against the short signal book. And it's a really collaborative effort by a whole series of different teams at Bletchley Park. We're used to Bletchley being really, really compartmentalised, but this is one of the occasions when, luckily, enough people talk to enough other people about what they're doing that you get a really collaborative effort. And it's quite complicated to explain it because it has so many elements to it, but it is that really collaborative effort. And Hugh Alexander, who took over from Turing as the head of Hut 8, responsible for naval enigma breaking, talked about exactly this. He describes the fundamental importance of the teamwork.
In the WW period, Archer was our prop and standby, and we received valuable but subsidiary assistance from Naval Section 4. In the B-bar months, the position was reversed, Naval Section 4 under Edgar Jackson being absolutely essential to us, while the chief value of Archer was to help us to break into the new WW book, a task which proved to be of only secondary importance. The whole of the WW and B-bar period was most interesting, and contains several important lessons. First, it shows the great importance of close cooperation, in the narrower field between all cryptographic sections, and in the larger field between all sections, between everybody working in any way on a problem of this kind. In breaking WWs and B-bars, the following groups of people were involved. 1. Hut 8. 2. The Met section, under Archer. 3. The U-boat room, Naval Section 4. 4. The Z-Watch, Naval Section 2, who translated the decodes and would see all the shark short signal acknowledgements. 5. The DF stations all over the world. 6. The Admiralty, providing position reports from our ships and sighting by coastal command. All this in addition to intercept stations, the Bomb Hut, and Scarborough. The Hut 8 cryptographers, sitting down on their own with the messages in front of them and trying to get it out by genius, would have got nothing but a headache. This sort of cooperation was vital all through, but the WWs and B-bars provide a very clear-cut and complete example.
Extract from Cryptographic History of Work on the German Naval Enigma by CHOD Alexander. Hugh Alexander, head of Hut 8, November 1942 to October 1944.
Can you tell us then what this all meant? What were the consequences of Bletchley Park being able to read Shark?
Well, as I've described, there are periods when it's not so important and periods when it really is important. And when it first comes in, because of the individual attacks on the US coast, not such a big factor. Second half of 1942, it's a real worry. But the fact that they can read it after the Petard Pinch, after October, is of crucial importance because the spring of 1943 is a period when Dönitz makes a concerted, fresh effort in the Atlantic, and it's a period of particularly fierce combat between convoys and U-boats. So being able to read the traffic at that point is really important. If you just look at the statistics, the first message after they've captured the books, the first message teleprinted to the Admiralty, first decrypted U-boat message, is at 14:17 hours on the 13th of December 1942. From then until 1945, they break another 39,000 messages.
Wow.
So it's a huge volume of intelligence. And in that period, up until March, when the U-boats are very active, they manage to get the Shark key for 88 out of 99 days. At this point, there's no American bomb machines in operation yet. This is purely using the cribs and using archery and using the weather messages.
Wow.
It's an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, the 39,000 more messages includes the messages broken by the bombs, but that's 88 out of 99 days, that's people breaking weather messages, which is a really impressive achievement. And it goes through that period, which is really critical. And as I said, in March, the short weather signal book is changed, so they have to go to the B-bar, as it's called, the general short signal book. And again, they break 87 days out of 112 between March and June. So they're really, really successful with these, what are essentially handbraking techniques. And June is significant because on the 20th of May, Dönitz suspends operations in the Atlantic almost completely. He admits defeat in the Battle of the Atlantic and goes, right, the U-boats can all go back to France while we have a rethink because it's getting too costly for us. In fact, they have a renewed offensive in the autumn of 1943, and they carry on into 1944 and 1945, but it's never as bad as it was in late 42 and early 43. The peak of the Battle of the Atlantic is over by that point. And the Germans withdraw from the Atlantic in the summer of 1943 because they have essentially been beaten. And that's not just down to Enigma, it's down to better radar, better air cover, better escort ships, a whole myriad of factors. But like I always say, it's a table with a lot of legs, mm-hmm. but you don't want to snap any one of the legs off because the table will fall over. Signals intelligence, and this breaking of Shark is definitely one of those legs. So really, really important. And later on, once four rotor bomb machines are available, along with the other technologies, it's kind of all over for the U-boats. But what's important for this story, and as we remember the anniversary of U-559, we so often talk about geniuses at Bletchley Park, and a lot of this story is about how I've described with the archery and the B-bar messages and all that. There's incredible code-breaking expertise being applied. But none of that would have been possible without the stone-cold bravery of those two men, Anthony Fasten and Colin Grazier, going aboard that submarine.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.